Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 3rd, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. I'll be talking to you about what happened this week. This week's a little bit interesting for me because I spent most of the week on the road. I was actually traveling all the way out to the U.S. Virgin Islands, was on both St. Thomas and St. Croix. For 2 different days, a presentation on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So I've been a bit moving around, shall we say, and out of place during this week and had some long airfares going to and from because coming from Phoenix all the way out to U.S. Virgin Islands is about 5 hours to get to Miami to your jumping off point, and then about 3 hours from there and your time at the airport. So a couple of 10-hour days, shall we say, where you're doing nothing much but traveling. So it's been interesting because, of course, the IRS decided to do some things this week. First thing we're going to discuss is the IRS released the 163J interest deduction proposed regulations that we've been waiting for. They also added a special revenue procedure dealing with infrastructure maintenance companies and how that might be impacted by under 163J. It would allow those companies to be treated as real estate companies for this purpose. We have an IRS memorandum that described what the IRS believes they can question if an employer claims that amounts that they are paying for employee meals should not have to be added to the employee's W-2 under Section 119. The IRS issued another 300 pages of regulations on foreign tax credits that mainly are aimed at issues that are going to arise with corporations. And we also have the automatic accounting method change procedures finally issued for the 451B revenue conformity rules for those with applicable financial statements. So it's been a nice, long, messy week. And because of that, let me go ahead and get into what we have here today. We're going to start out with the proposed regulations for interest, and that's under Regulation 106-08918. They were issued on November the 26th of 2018. And these are those long-awaited proposed regulations dealing with the limitation on deductions on business interest. In essence, interest is limited now to 30% of what's called adjusted taxable income, or ATI, as you'll see it in the regulations. The idea of Congress is to limit and try to reduce the reliance upon borrowed funds. Congress, for whatever reason they may feel, believe that if you were heavily borrowing funds in order to grow, that wasn't a good thing. Maybe, you know, the argument could be, I guess, supposedly that it's risky, that it makes the economy a bit riskier to have all these highly leveraged enterprises out here that'll collapse quickly if things go downhill. And the 30% ATI is going to be effectively tax based as earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization through 2021. So you'll be able to add back your depreciation, amortization, and depletion through 2021, along with the interest and the taxes, and your interest can be no more than 30% of that. However, after 2021, Congress says we're getting more serious. In 2022 and later, it's just going to be earnings before interest and taxes. Depreciation and, you know, depreciation, amortization, and depletion will count against you. And that's significant because, remember, we have bonus depreciation now. It's at 100%. And yes, it's scheduled to go away, but Congress has a knack of extending those things. And the problem becomes if you have lots of equipment, lots of bonus depreciation, you may find yourself a little bit troubled trying to get to the 30% limitation and not losing your interest. So it's an interesting issue if you're covered by it. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to this. And one of the big ones is if you qualify under 448C to use the cash basis of accounting, and after the changes of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that means you have average revenues of less than $25 million after we aggregate using rules that are borrowed from the jobs credit and also from what are considered to be related parties for pension plan purposes under 414. If we don't have $25 million there, then we're not subject to this rule. So, you know, small businesses are excluded from the limitation. We also have a couple of other interesting asides to work with there, but basically we're looking at this for larger, mid-sized, large companies. We're going to use $25 million as that cutoff. The regs give us a definition of interest, and it is a very expansive one. If you're going to be affected by this, go into the first regulation and take a look in the definitions under what's interest. There is a long list of items that are going to be considered interest, and it's interest that we traditionally have, but also, you know, any type of expense or, you know, amortized or whatever type of item it is that looks like it's a payment for use of money, even if it's not called interest for tax purposes, those will all be captured under these regulations. There are some businesses that are excluded from this category. We already told you about the $25 million limitation. We have some that are non-elective. If you are basically a motor vehicle dealer, and motor vehicles are defined essentially to include automobiles, boats, and farm equipment, and you have flooring account interest, good news is the flooring account interest will not be limited. The bad news is you're going to lose bonus depreciation non-electively. And you'll still have limitations on your non-flooring interest. That'll still be subjected to the 30% limit. Also, if you are a regulated public utility, you know, like you're a water company, electric company, you have rates set by a public body, they're also excluded from this, but they also don't get bonus depreciation. Now, there's another category of businesses that are elective. Those elective businesses include any real property trade or business, and for this purpose, they go to the definition that we find under 469C7 for what were the types of businesses one could be in to be a real estate professional. So it means that, you know, we're going to use that same list of business types for this purpose. And that also means, interestingly enough, we actually have in the middle of these proposed regs changes to the regulations under 469 that deal with the definition of a real estate professional. They don't really change a whole lot, but they do answer a couple of questions about who could and couldn't qualify. They do make it clear, this was mentioned by Tony Nitti on Twitter, that effectively, if you'd had this theory for a while, that, well, you know, a janitor is actually a guy who does services. He cleans up buildings. That's real property. So would a janitorial service be a, you know, would that be a real estate professional if you were involved in a janitorial service, you know, you were owned one? The answer is no. They make that pretty clear at this point. They'd be sort of, you know, other things that are tangentially related to the real property, but aren't directly with real property trades or businesses, they don't qualify. They do tell you in here how to make your elections, right? Oh, I should say the other category is farming category. Now, in both cases, if you elect, you give up some bonus depreciation situations. Real property trades or business have to use ADS on all real property. Now, there is some confusion. The way the law is written, it's not totally clear if that's just for new things that go in after you make this election, or if you have to restate everything. By the way, restating everything could be a major problem, because while ADS now is very close to the regular depreciable life, ADS previously was much longer than the regular depreciable life. And if we have to go back and restate those things we acquired back in 2002 or 2010 and treat those as ADS lives, well, that could make that a little nasty. We'll see if the IRS clarifies that in final regulations. If you're a farm, anything that has a 10-year life or greater, you have to use ADS on. So you're not going to get bonus depreciation on your greenhouse. You know, and again, in both cases, you're going to be losing it on items, let's say, like qualified improvement property. So when we finally get that back and the retail glitch is fixed, which probably will happen eventually. We just don't know how long eventually will be. You know, at that point, you'll still give those up. In both cases, we give those up permanently. If you want to make this election because it doesn't matter to you, we're never going to be able to get below 30% on interest. They do tell you how to make the election. It's going to be through IRS instructions, as you might expect. And, you know, it has to be made. They give you information on that election in the proposed regulations. They also talk about, what if your business has both a real estate activity and another activity? Well, this is kind of like the 199 Cap A regulations, that we have to figure out how many trades or businesses we have, because this limitation is on trades or businesses. And they do tell you how to allocate interest if you do have both types. One interesting item they tell us is, we're going to allocate interest not by tracing it, because the IRS decided that was too complicated, not by relative fair value of assets, because the IRS told us that was too complicated. Side note, but apparently they never talked to the people that wrote the 199 Cap A regulations, because as we've discussed previously, partnerships have to try for how to do their UBIA by looking at fair value of assets if they're not currently being depreciated. This regulation tells you that those fair value issues would be rather difficult to do. It's tough to tie down. There'd be way too many disputes. It's administratively way too, it's crazy. It costs more than any benefit. Apparently, the people who wrote this regulations were not writing the ones under 199 Cap A. But we will. But how will we do it? you're going to go back and do ADS depreciation. It will be the way you're going to figure out your adjusted basis for assets. And that's how you're then going to allocate the interest. So again, ADS, because of course you're having to deal with the fact that bonus is going to wipe out adjusted basis. So they're going to go ahead and try to use ADS depreciation. Does mean that we need ADS depreciation schedules in order to figure out how to allocate our interest. Okay. There are special rules in this for partnerships and S corporations. Interestingly enough, there were a couple ways you could have read the law. The IRS reads the law to have different rules for partnerships and S corporations, which is interesting because the law kept telling us these rules for partnerships and S corporations are generally set and other entities to be similar in most cases, but not all. And that's what the IRS picked up on. So in a case of a partnership, partnerships and S corporations are going to have a strange rule that it's going to still silo these. So if we have, you know, excess interest in the partnership this year, I can't absorb that by having extra income in another trade or business. But it turns out that for a partnership and an S corporation, there are, you know, what's going to happen is when it does come out later, because you have excess income in the partnership, that's going to come out, but then still be tested under your standard test, which is kind of interesting. The S corp, the rule is very simple. Everything's kind of an inside the box test. We'll see if that stays put, because the IRS admitted they're reading. There's a couple ways to read what was written. And one way is that everything's always inside the box, inside the silo, regardless of a partnership or S corp. But the other way is to say, no, the silo, when it comes out, only applies to the S corp. The partnerships, it comes out, and then we have to look at everything else you've got to see how things go. So we'll see how this comes. Obviously, these regulations are new. The form is out. If you want to see the draft form on the IRS website, I can't remember the number for sure, 8926 hits me as a number, but it's out there in draft form. So, you know, we have some information on this. Along with this, the IRS also released an actual one. Revenue Procedure 2018-59 was released at the same time. This revenue procedure was issued to go with these proposed regulations. And it's meant to address a set of businesses that are known as core infrastructure property maintenance companies. Now, core infrastructure property includes items such as road, bridges, similar properties. There is a list in the regulation of things that are core infrastructure items. So you want to go take a look at that and see what that is. Businesses who are in this, who are core infrastructure maintenance businesses that are contracting with a governmental agency, they can elect to be a real property business for purpose of 169J. That would allow them to make the election to basically get out of the 30% limitation if they want to. Now, the infrastructure property you buy, therefore, the stuff that you're doing and the things you put in there, they're going to be treated as real property. Remember, real property has to be ADS and no bonus. So we're giving up some stuff. We go this route. Again, it's going to be if interest is going to be a major problem for you. Okay. There is a list in the regulation of what will be considered infrastructure property that if you're hired by a governmental agency to do maintenance on, you know, and to maintain and keep up, then you're going to be able to make this election. You'll take a look at that list of 17 and say roads, bridges, other similar things are in there. Brownfields are in there. All kinds of odd things are in the list of the 17 infrastructure property items. It must be public infrastructure property. So, you know, if you do this same work for a private company maintaining something, it might still be infrastructure, but if it's owned privately, it's not going to be able to be qualified for this election. And the election does not impact real property businesses for 469. So if your guy is a pass-through entity and you're the owner and you've got all these hours in here, great, you're real property for this purpose, but that will not make you a real estate professional to allow you to claim to be a real estate pro on your buildings or on your rentals. Okay, the IRS said, yeah, we're doing this just for this rule. I know it says 469C7, but we're going to let you elect only for purposes of this rule to be a real estate business. You're still not one for passive activity rules. So you still can't make use of that. Well, the IRS has now solved the pizza problem, well, at least in their minds. This is their memorandum, Advanced Memorandum 2018-004, issued on November 22nd. This memorandum was discussing what can the IRS question if an employer is saying that I'm paying for these meals for my employees and they're not taxable wages to the employees. You know, generally, any fringe benefit you provide to an employee is taxable unless there's a specific exclusion under the code. Now, as far as deducting that meal for the employer, take a look at 274E1. You know, meals for employees or potentially meals for meetings, which is another exception, or 274E, would govern the deduction at the employer level. This is looking at, do we have to throw it in the W-2 of the employee? And, you know, they've got employers who have said no. Historically, this goes back to a Kowalski case from the 50s that was set a standard in the U.S. Supreme Court. Under Kowalski, you know, that they said that, you know, what Congress did in the 56 code, which then became part of the 86 code, 54 code, I guess it was, then became the 86 code, was they made some changes to the rules here, but they still meant that the meals had to be for the convenience of the employer, as opposed to just an employee benefit, something employees wanted. I mean, hey, who doesn't like free food, right? But, you know, the catch is, but the employer therefore has a business reason for providing these meals. And Kowalski put that standard in. Now, Congress came along a few years later and added section 119B2. That section, per the committee reports, was added principally because the IRS had taken a position that if an employer charged for the meal, charged the employee something, let's say a reduced cost for the meal, and the employees had the right to decline that, you know, discounted amount and, you know, take care of the meal otherwise, that was basically per se evidence that this was not for the benefit of the employer or the convenience of the employer. Congress felt that wasn't what was meant. The case that took a look at that first was the Boyd Gaming case. And Boyd Gaming was a casino. The casino was giving meals to the employees who worked inside the casino. And they stated it was because they needed to have them available quickly. You know, they needed them for security and other reasons. And they had them on site. The IRS attempted to go deep into the whole question about whether that could be a legitimate reason or not. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said you cannot second guess the business management of Boyd Gaming. We're going to accept that that was a legitimate reason. Now the IRS says they have employers who are stating, well, you know, we pay for lunches for all of our employees because, you know, we like the camaraderie. You know, we think camaraderie is good, we're important. You know, or, you know, they'll be able to get ideas, or they won't talk accidentally outside the office about this thing that's very, very deep secret. And the IRS is wondering, you know, can we actually question that? And the employer is saying, no, per Boyd Gaming and 119B2, that's off limits. You can't talk to us about that. You know, you can't take a look at that. Not surprisingly, the IRS doesn't totally agree with that. The memo argues the IRS can question these things. First thing they say, if you have a policy, are employees made aware of that policy or not? You know, if your claim is we're doing this lunch so that people, you know, don't talk about business outside the office, have we told employees it's illegal to talk about that stuff over lunch? You can't have conversations over lunch, you know, or at meals. If you have a meal outside of this facility, don't talk about anything you're doing inside the company. You know, have we told them that during lunches that we expect them to interact and network with each other, that's a requirement, you know, in essence, or have, you know, are we just papering it over by making those statements? You know, secondly, if it really have a policy, is it enforced? For instance, if employees are supposed to eat lunch at the office, at the campus, because we're concerned about them discussing things off campus, if they had lunch off campus, you know, that a couple of employees go off campus for lunch, that they could end up discussing things that are secret and hurt us. Well, that seems like the sort of thing that should say that you can't go off campus for lunch. It's not allowed. Do we enforce such a policy? Or have people been disciplined? You know, do people apply to get out of that for special cases? I mean, you know, does it appear it's a real policy and not just a claimed policy? Okay. Does the employer offer a justification linking meals to the policy? You know, okay, why is camaraderie important? What's your justification for that? Why is it important they stay here? You know, if the employer says it's because there are emergencies, what type of emergencies has occurred? When do they occur? How often do they occur? You know, what's the purpose here of that? You know, is there a justification? The evidence an employer can present to back this up can include Employee manuals could describe the policy. That's considered to be evidence that it's a real policy. And therefore, again, if it's a real policy that has legitimate reason other than getting an LMB of the employees to have that pizza without having it in their W-2, that's fine. We can deal with that. We can also take a look at that to be written. They said we could look at disciplinary records, though. Maybe we don't have a written policy about not, you know, not having lunch outside the building, but it's a policy everybody's aware of, you know, that we do orally, and people have actually been disciplined for having lunches away from the office because of that high risk of disclosing this deep, dark secret thing that we're trying to keep wraps under so that we can surprise the market, you know, and make a ton of money. It's an interesting set of deals. Now, again, 119 meals are only dealing with the employee side of this, you know, the taxation of the employee. The employer, again, 274 governs that. 274E is where you look for your exceptions there for the employer. It's an interesting case. It goes back to Boyd Gaming. It does suggest that the service may start asking more questions about these policies. So it's probably important to document these things. You know, why do we do this? Like in a CPA firm, why do we have pizza on, let's say, Saturdays and tax season? What's the justification for it? You know, is it truly for the convenience of the employer? You know, you can tell us it's because, you know, the people need to be working down here. You know, we don't want to lose time, so we want them to have the pizza. You know, we're now electronics. We don't worry about them getting the work papers greasy, I guess, anymore. Just they now get the keyboard greasy. That doesn't sound good. But still, whatever. You know, come up with your justification for why you're doing it. And then be able to back that up. And don't just write up a policy that nobody knows about to try to defend it. Well, we have another set, 300 pages of regulations I want to mention here. Won't go too deep into this because the big impacts here are primarily, and there's a good article written by Richard Rubin in the Wall Street Journal that talked about, you know, why this was a problem. But we have new regulations dealing with new issues for the foreign tax credit. They're about 300 pages. They're triggered by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the GILTI rules, various other items have now, you know, complicated foreign tax credits, but more involved than it used to be, especially for corporations. And the real problem now is that because corporate rates now in the U.S. have been reduced so much, many, many more corporations are finding their foreign tax credits limited. It used to be there was no problem. You know, you never could have excess income that caused you problems on the foreign tax credit. You know, you never had basically, let's say, too little tax. You could always offset it. Now a whole lot more people have to offset. And a problem that's discovered, this is brought up in the Wall Street Journal article, is because of the way you do this, there are situations where if I can move expenses to the offshore operation, I actually can reduce my taxes overall combined U.S. and foreign by maximizing the use of the foreign tax credit. And that, you know, that basically to offset my U.S. taxes while also reducing my foreign taxes, it's a win-win. Except that wasn't supposed to be the point of this law. Now, the Treasury did, and the Wall Street Journal is quoted as offering up what the Treasury officials call a 50% solution. Treasury does not believe they can fix the whole problem, you know, get rid of that incentive to go offshore without congressional changes. What's the chance we'll get those changes? Same chance as any tax correction. Who knows how we're going to be dealing with that. Finally, we've gotten Revenue Procedure 2018-60 issue on November 28th. We have an automatic revenue procedure that sets up automatic changes for taxpayers who are going to need to change their revenue recognition for tax purposes because of Section 451B added by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. For those who don't remember, 451B says you have to recognize revenue if you have an Apple financial statement. You have to recognize revenue at least as quickly as you do on that financial statement, the AFS, assuming you're subject to you're an accrual taxpayer subject to the all events test. Well, the problem is that would be changing timing of income. That would seem to be an accounting method change. The IRS agrees it's a method change. They give us a simplified set of Form 3115 filings for this change. One of the neat things about this is you don't have to send the extra copy to Covington, Kentucky. That's kind of interesting. Just a copy goes with the return. And in fact, many taxpayers could qualify for a no Form 3115 filing. If you have an AFS, you're going to be subjected to this. It's going to impact you. You can actually do it without even filing 3115 if you are either a small business that qualifies for the 20, that's under 25 million, qualifies for cash basis, but it's not on cash basis. Because you're on cash basis, this won't apply to you. But then it'll go to cash basis. They have an AFS. So they'd be subject to it. They could do this just by changing, just by doing it. There's no 3015 required. Or for any other business, if there's not going to be any current 41A adjustment when we make the change from last year to this year. And that last one kind of covers us, because then it means like if 2 years from now we do a contract that now suddenly, you know, makes GAAP revenue recognition for that particular set of circumstances now be faster than tax. Well, we've already made our accounting method change in theory this year by doing this non-audit, by doing this change with no 41A adjustment. Now, the problem is that this accounting method change revenue procedure is written by an attorney. An attorney trying to explain GAAP. This makes things kind of fun. The way I read it, it's pretty clear you cannot use this method to adopt the ASC 606 methods at the same time. Now, what do I think is meant by that? Because obviously, if you're doing GAAP financials, you're going to be adopting ASC 606 on your GAAP books. But remember, we had an earlier revenue procedure that allowed you, if your ASC 606 method is acceptable for tax purposes, and the IRS is not telling us for sure what ASC 606 methods are acceptable, but if they're acceptable, you could get automatic relief, or you could get automatic change to go from 605's way of doing revenue that you probably were using for tax purposes to 606's in the year you make your change. It would appear to me that the IRS is saying here, if you want to do that, because that would also mean if ASC 606 slows up your reporting versus what you were previously doing, so that you're going to report slower for taxes on some contracts, that's where they're going to want you to file for a special change method. You'll get automatic change. They won't tell you for sure till the exam if they do or don't believe that, you know, that clearly reflects income. But if you need to do that, if you want to get both sides of the 606, both when it's faster than what you're doing now and when it's slower in recognition of what you're doing now, so you want to be able to pick up both sides, that I think apparently still requires the second 3515 filing for the year in which you adopt these changes of accounting methods, you know, when you adopt 606. Now, what's not totally clear to me is what happens to the non-public company that is on 605 this year, makes the automatic change. Then next year, 606 comes in play, and it ended up being accelerating some recognition versus this last year in some categories. I think we can read this ruling to state that you're okay there, because the IRS is kind of backdoor saying 451B effectively makes GAAP an accounting method, which is contrary to anything before. Following GAAP was not a method. But they're saying here, this is just saying you met the all events test, so you're just following the all events test for the code. But it's not totally clear. Hopefully somebody clears that up a little bit for us before we go further on this. Now remember, what's an AFS? An AFS, and if you don't have one, you don't need to worry about this. AFS is a statement filed with the SEC. Okay, if you're a public company, that's your AFS. If you're not a public company, if you have an audited financial statement done for a substantial non-tax reason, I've never seen one done not for a substantial non-tax reason, so an audited financial statement would be your AFS if you don't have the one going to the SEC. Quite often, one going to the SEC is the audit statement. So, you know, but nevertheless, the audit statement would be there even if you don't go with the SEC. Third category is any statement filed with a federal government agency. That's your AFS if you don't have an audited statement or you don't have an SEC statement. There's also a special rule if you're not a corporation formed in the U.S., but your corporation is basically having to report to an SEC equivalent in a foreign country. Let's say you had to report to Germany, Germany's SEC equivalent. Then your IFRS statement there would become your applicable financial statement. It would basically be substituted for the SEC statement. But if you have both that and SEC statement, the SEC statement will always carry. Okay. Now it's kind of interesting. You know, how that runs. And also remember, it doesn't apply if you're not using the all events test under 451. If using a special method of accounting, for instance, it would appear it does not apply if you are a construction contractor using percentage of completion method. Why? Because PCM is, you know, percentage of completion method is a special method under 460, different than 451. And because of that, you're not using 451. So 451's rules don't apply to you. You know, in essence, at least this part, the all events test for when you pick up revenue doesn't apply. You have to look to PCM for when you pick up revenue. So, you know, be aware, it also won't apply if you're not accrual basis. So again, if you're under 25 million and you elect to go cash basis, this rule doesn't apply. You still have that audited accrual basis financial statement, and you won't have a problem over here. In any event, if you do have that issue where we have revenue conformity problems, you have the AFS, and you are not going to be on the cash basis, and you're not a construction contractor, I would certainly take a look at this rev proc. You're going to need to do this year to do your conversion over, to do your quote conversion over, and then go forward. Now, what'll be more interesting in the future is watch to see how the service reacts. What happens if we don't have an audit statement this year, but 4 years from now we have an audit statement? You know, do we then, you know, how do we make our change then? Probably doing the similar thing. It's also going to be interesting what happens in the year when we don't have an AFS. Are the IRS going to interpret that our method is still to follow our financial statement, even though it's now reviewed? Or are they going to say, well, yeah, this year no AFS, don't worry about GAAP conformity, go to whatever. This still could be unanswered questions as the thing develops over time. I think a few things are going to be clarified. Well, we are in December now. It is that last month of the year. State society courses are running. This week, I've got 3 days in Indianapolis that'll be doing. The following week, I'm going to have 2 days up in Minnesota. We're going to be doing financial estate and tax planning for those over 55 on day one. If I recall, that's the case. Of course, you can check in their guide. But I'll also be doing a wrap-up of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act for business issues, which primarily looks at 199 Cap A, the business, you know, the qualified business income rules. We're going to spend most of the day on that. In fact, when I gave that course here in Phoenix, we spent essentially like 7 hours of the 8 hours just beating up on the 199 Cap A rules. So if you want to have a refresher on 199 Cap A and you're going to be in the Bloomington, Minnesota area coming up next week, check the Minnesota Society's website. They'll tell you how to sign up and be part of that course in Bloomington, because there's no place better in the winter to go for vacation than Bloomington. Well, okay, maybe that's not true, but hey, you know, still, you're going to get your 199 Cap A. So come join us there in Bloomington. It's nice. It'll be heated. You know, we'll bring you inside. Don't worry about that. You know, we won't hold things outside like the breakfast I had in St. Croix Saturday morning before coming home. Don't think I'm going to be having those breakfasts outside either in Indianapolis or Bloomington. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 3rd. You can follow our updates as we post them at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll post some written materials there. You can also follow my comments online. I'm, you know, on Twitter at Ed Zollers. If you have questions, email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Also, I do follow discussions on Reddit, reddit.com/r/taxpros, or on some state society websites. I am following state society discussions to at least some extent on California's discussion group, which is Tax Talk, that is open to anybody who's a CPA. Also, Arizona Society, New Jersey Society, and Minnesota Society's Connect groups. I follow any discussions there. So if you want to, you know, you want to post a question, take a look at things, you can look in there. You know, so just kind of do as you will. Well, going to have another fun week. Again, I'll be in Indianapolis, so I've got another week of juggling to get updates put together, so that this could still be interesting. But we'll hopefully next week I'll come back and I'll give you what I've got. We'll see. Hopefully I get things recorded next Saturday before I have to leave for Bloomington. Otherwise, I may be giving it from Bloomington late on Sunday. But, you know, make sure you tune in, see what's happening, and we'll hopefully try to keep you up over the next few weeks on what's happening here with developments. Seems like the IRS now is in rush mode to get as much out as they can for the end of the year on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in some areas. So I suspect we may have a few things to talk about. So hopefully we'll see you next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.